From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, we examine the life of one of this century's great artists, Jackson Pollock. Stephen Nayfay and Gregory White-Smith join us to talk about their new biography of Pollock, a project that took them 8 years to research and write. Also today, master geographer Wilbur Zielinski tells us why his craft is more than maps, it's who we are. World music critic Milo Miles takes us to the movies in India, and critic Laurie Stone reviews comic Jim Turner's show titled Walk a Mile in My Head. You'll hear all this when you stroll in today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. Federal investigators say that a Colombian jetliner ran out of fuel before it crashed last night outside of New York City. At least 66 people were killed, more than 85 survived. There was no explosion when the Avianca Airlines Flight 52 from Bogota crashed into a hillside, and there was no fire, leading investigators to conclude the plane was out of fuel. The plane was headed for Kennedy International Airport and had aborted a landing in fog and rain. It was making a second approach when the crew reported it was having engine trouble. It crashed a short time later. A federal judge today ordered deposed Panamanian dictator Manuel Noriega, held without bond. His attorneys did not refute prosecution claims that Noriega would flee the country if set free. Instead, they asked their client be declared a prisoner of war and transferred to a neutral country. The judge in the case has not considered that motion. The decision by the Kremlin to send troops to the Azerbaijani capital of Baku has been condemned by a group of radical deputies in the Soviet parliament. At a news conference in Moscow, they demanded an emergency session of parliament be called to consider the crisis. The BBC's Tim Hewell reports from Moscow.
The news conference was called by the interregional group, which represents the most radical members of the Soviet legislature. They are angry that the decision to send troops into Baku was taken without consulting Parliament, which is in recess until the middle of next month. One deputy, Yuri Afanasyev, said that the decision had been taken by a narrow circle of people in mysterious circumstances, so that in the end it was unclear who bore responsibility. The interregional group believes it's right to use troops, if necessary, to protect civilian lives. But some deputies suspect that wasn't the main motive for the military operation in Baku. They have pointed out that the attacks on Armenians in the Azerbaijani capital were already over when the soldiers arrived. The main aim of the intervention, therefore, may have been to prevent power passing from the Communist Party to the Azerbaijan Popular Front.
The Minneapolis City Council today approved a controversial civilian review plan to oversee police conduct, UN Care reports.
A year ago, almost to the day, an elderly black couple died when a misfiring flash grenade used during a Minneapolis police drug raid set their house on fire. Officers were cleared of wrongdoing, but the incident led to claims of police brutality. Despite hundreds of complaints filed over the last 6 years against Minneapolis police, not one allegation of brutality has been upheld by the Minneapolis Police Internal Affairs Unit. City Council members say they hope the new board will restore faith in what they describe as a fine police department. However, officers say the board will make their job more dangerous. They say they'll be less aggressive in perilous situations and thus more likely to get hurt. Earlier this week, the department's SWAT team threatened to resign over the issue, but now say they will gather signatures to show public opposition to civilian review. For National Public Radio, I'm Ewan Kerr in Minneapolis.
Stock prices were down on Wall Street. This is NPR News. President Bush's son Neil said today he intends to fight conflict of interest charges leveled by the federal thrift regulators. Neil Bush said his father told him to do what was right. The decision may put the president in the awkward position of appointing the official likely to decide the case. But Neil Bush said after talking with his father earlier in the day he did not believe that would be a problem. The Office of Thrift Supervision said today it will issue a notice of charges, alleging that actions by the younger Bush as director of a Colorado savings and loan amounted to conflicts of interest. Opposition groups in East Germany said today they're willing to join a transitional government. Deidre Berger has more.
For the first time, the East German opposition says it is prepared to share leadership responsibility. Currently, the communists head a government coalition of parties who traditionally were closely linked to the communists. But opposition leaders said they would only join the government if East German leader Hans Modrow and all other government ministers drop their party membership. Furthermore, the opposition insists the new coalition government be nominated by members of the Round Table. In Vienna today, on an official state visit, Prime Minister Hans Modrow would not commit himself to opposition demands, but he unleashed speculation he might leave the Communist Party when he told reporters his main responsibility was not to the party, but to the East German people. The East German opposition says it is interested in ministries such as economy, environment, state, interior, and labor. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger reporting.
A federal jury today began sifting through more than 1,000 documents and other evidence in the trial of a $10 million criminal fraud case against General Electric and two of its executives. The case arose from a 1983 Army contract with GE to produce a battlefield computer vehicle. I'm Frank Stachow, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Terry Gross returns next time. I'm Sedge Thompson. My guests today are the co-authors of Jackson Pollock, An American Saga, Stephen Nafe and Gregory White-Smith. The biography tells a story of the cultural history of the United States from the last century to the mid-1950s. The biographers use the elaborate history as the setting for Jackson Pollock's own life. The authors are graduates of the Harvard Law School and eventually gave up the practice of law to write. This current collaboration took Nafe and Smith 8 years to research and write, including 2,000 interviews with 850 people who knew Pollock and his friends. The authors kept an elaborate card system to cross-reference different versions of the same stories, and over 100 pages of the book are devoted to identifying the sources of the anecdotes they use. They said it's as carefully prepared as a legal brief. In the course of their research, Pollock's widow, Lee Krasner, granted several interviews, as did members of the artist's family. The biography has engendered some controversy based on the author's conclusion about the artist's life, but Smith and Nafe say they needed to establish the setting for their conclusion about Pollock by building up the historical detail and lives of people around Pollock. In addition to a profile of Lee Krasner and her paintings, the book has substantial sections devoted to major figures in his life, including the painter Thomas Hart Benton, whose work as originalist and teacher influenced both Pollock and the art world. It seemed there must have been a point when the authors realized their biography would have to expand beyond the details of Pollock's life to include the background of Benton and the psychological aspects of other artists. I asked Nafe and Smith how different their completed biography is from that they first envisioned.
We began with a much more limited idea of what we were trying to do. And as we researched and got deeper and deeper, our ambitions for the project grew.
We also, it became apparent to us that one of the sort of central themes of our book was the place of art in American society and how this affected the artist, and in particular, that in the 19th century America, art was seen as women's activity. It was something that a farm wife would involve herself in, either in terms of taking little painting classes or reading poetry or having little clubs that they would come to and give talks on artists in Tingley, Iowa, where his mother was born. It's really quite wonderful to think that these farm women would gather and give talks on Rosa Bonheur or Raphael. Meanwhile, of course, their husbands had nothing to do with this and thought it was essentially a women's activity. Well, for the sons of these people, becoming artists was necessarily a potential problem, especially if their egos were at all insecure, and as were Pollock's own ego and Thomas Hart Benton's, so we tell the story partly to show that the problems Jackson faced in becoming an artist in a world in which art was considered a sissy activity were the same problems that other artists faced, but reacted to them differently. And in Benton's case, he tried to compensate for this. Especially after his father's death, and at the time of his father's death, he turned strictly from abstract art to a kind of to the better known regionalist style, and in particular to a kind of populist subject matter that was his effort to make that art acceptable to his father. And this is not just our psychoanalytic explanation. He really discusses that switch fairly articulately himself in his many writings and autobiographical writings.
I think you also go into chapters also on Krishnamurti and on some of the Jungian ideas that attracted Pollock?
Well, one of the things that came through very clearly was that Jackson had a very different kind of intelligence. We've been criticized for suggesting that Jackson was not an intelligent person, somehow demeaning him. In fact, we do not say that at all. What we say, to paraphrase one of his own analysts, is that Jackson had an intelligence that was very different from most of the people who are listening to this show. He was not a verbal person. He did not understand things on a verbal level. He understood them on an intuitive level. On that intuitive level, he was extremely intelligent, extremely acute, but he didn't really understand them in the ways that many of us might understand them. We felt it was important to convey that.
I was interested in your account of how Pollock began his drip paintings to bring in sort of the idea of the hallucinations that he may have had inspired by migraines.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's brand new information. That's never been known before. It wasn't that he had the migraines and then painted them. The source on this is very clear that Jackson, after he began to paint the drip paintings, realized that he had seen the image before in the I guess they're called optical hallucinations that he had had periodically throughout his life.
But he had what are all clinically known as ocular migraines. These take different forms, but in Jackson's case, it was like small specks would whirl around in his field of vision. He thought he was going crazy or else that he was going blind. Roger, who had done a lot of work in the area of optical science, was able to reassure him that, in fact, he wasn't going crazy and that he wasn't going blind, that this was a... These were the results of certain kinds of migraines, not the kind of migraine that gives you a headache, but the kind of migraine that gives you one of these optical patterns. Jackson himself commented on how these images resembled the swirling patterns in many of his drip paintings. The other thing that we learned, which was probably even more significant, and we think this is critical to understanding those images, is that when Jackson was dripping paint, he was not creating a two-dimensional image. He was not creating a two-dimensional abstract image, even though the Greenbergians have tried to suggest that over the years. In fact, as several of his closest friend painters described to us, he was painting in the air. He was wrapping three-dimensional images in lariats of paint, which then would, because of gravity, fall to the ground and form two-dimensional abstract images. So that even in his most abstract paintings, there is a subject matter that was contained in the air at the time he painted the painting, which later lost its recognizability. This was extremely important in understanding why his dripped paintings have the level of energy and passion that they have. They weren't simply decorative exercises. They were Jackson Pollock painting images, and like all of the images in his career, essentially demonic hallucinations from his daytime nightmares.
My guests are the authors of the new biography, Jackson Pollock, An American Saga, Stephen Nafe and Gregory White Smith. You know, his paintings have always sort of sprung out in a way with color and texture, and your description of how he painted makes it seem like I should see them springing out even more, like right out into the air, that seeing them as sort of drip as if going down a wall is the wrong way to view them.
No, that they were definitely they were painted in the air, and they have that that wonderful sense of liberation. In fact, I think one of the great benefits to us of writing this book was getting to know those paintings and getting to know them so well. And I must say, over 8 years, our respect and amazement at his achievement only increased. The quality of those paintings is really just quite staggering, especially, and this is another controversial aspect of the book, especially in view of his seeming technical lack of proficiency. I mean, when he first started painting, he had no ability to reproduce reality with any kind of academic skill. Far from seeming like a potential genius, his classmates in various art schools wondered if he could ever become an artist at all.
One of his great fears was whether or not he could draw, wasn't it?
Exactly, and he couldn't in the conventional sense. Of course, what he did is he created his own kind of draftsmanship, which he had an enormous control over, and those paintings have a non-academic draftsmanship, which is thrilling, but in terms of being able to take a typewriter to use his own example and reproduce it, that he just couldn't do that. And one of the miracles of his life is that he really sort of changed the rules. Instead of learning how to draw a typewriter, he changed the rules so that you didn't know how to draw a typewriter.
One of the challenges of doing a biography of Jackson Pollock is, other than his paintings and stories about him, he left a very small written record. What, like three letters you came across?
Well, it was very few and only a few notes. And not only did he leave a very limited written record, because he was so nonverbal, he relatively rarely discussed his work with other people. In fact, in the past, I think we were really the first researchers to have gone out and tried to find those few friends with whom Jackson felt comfortable talking about his art, and I think the book benefits enormously from from Jackson's own thoughts about his work and about his life. But it's true, it would have been far more desirable to have a huge stock of letters and diaries and journals and things. Instead, what we had to do frequently was to try to piece together his life, not from letters, but from the memories of people around him. And that's what I think that explains why we went out and interviewed more than 800 people. It was because we really had to, the slate was blank, and if we hadn't undertaken this massive research effort, I think the life would have passed us all by, because many of these people we were interviewing were getting quite old. Many of the most important interviewees have died. Lee Krasner herself, two of his oldest brothers, any number of close friends. We were lucky enough to begin our work just at the last point when a thorough account could have been obtained.
My guests are Stephen Nafe and Gregory White-Smith. They've just completed 8 years of research that led to their new biography, Jackson Pollock, An American Saga. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
I'm speaking with Stephen Nafe and Gregory White-Smith, the authors of a new biography of Jackson Pollock. You depict Jackson Pollock as a troubled man, confused about his sexuality, and from an early age given to great alcoholic binges. What was the role of alcohol in his life?
Well, he was an alcoholic, a severe one. In fact, all five brothers were at one stage or another alcoholics. In fact, he was committed for alcoholic psychosis to the Bloomingdale's, the institution in White Plains, and he was repeatedly taken to Bellevue in the middle of drunken binges. He rarely, however, ever painted when drunk, and in fact, alcohol, far from liberating him, really prevented him from painting much of the time. And many of his greatest paintings were done during the 2 years in Long Island when, under his wife Lee Krasner's care, he was able to more or less stop drinking for 2 years. And in the last 4 years of his life, he painted almost nothing because he was in a drunken state virtually all of the time. In terms of his sexual confusion, Jackson was something of a macho symbol to a whole generation of artists, and it has come as something of a shock to realize that he was subject to a certain amount of confusion. In fact, as a child, We heard stories about him demanding to play the mommy rather than the daddy and making little girls in the neighborhood play the daddy. Later in life, there were incidents, drunken incidents, in the homosexual subculture of New York, and his relations with women were extremely troubled. In almost every case of there were really only two other sexual liaisons other than Lee's, both of them extremely brief, and in both cases prompted by the woman. We go into this in considerable depth, not for any sensationalist effect, although some people might think so. The fact is, this was a man for whom sexuality was the subject matter of many of his paintings. He was, after all, a man who painted works like Male and Female, the great work at the Philadelphia Art Museum, which is a painting of a man with breasts and a woman with a penis. It seemed to us irresponsible not to try to understand why he was painting these paintings of confused sexuality. By the same token, so many of his paintings are portraits of his mother, whom he depicted as this outrageous monster, this bloated, naked woman with her legs wide open, wearing nothing but earrings and high-heeled shoes. And it seemed to us absolutely essential for a biographer to try to understand what in his relationship with this seemingly pleasant and conscientious housewife from the farms of Iowa would have prompted him to depict her as this ghoulish monster. And much of the book is an attempt to come to terms with those aspects of his life that made their way into his paintings.
You constantly make the point that he needed to rebel, and part of perhaps some of the outrageous stunts, the urinating at people in Peggy Guggenheim's fireplace, the fights that he would get into were to both call attention to himself as well as alienate people from him.
Right.
How was this taken in the New York art community at the time? Was he indulged in because he was an artist, or did this put people off?
You hit it. Ironically, the more famous he became, the more the limits melted, and the more the limits melted, the more he needed to do to get the kind of attention he wanted. So it really was kind of a vicious circle. As he garnered some, we'll call it fame, although we should keep in mind that it wasn't really fame in the modern sense. There are a lot of people who, it was more like infamy in some people's minds. As he became well-known, people became much more tolerant about his behavior. There was very much a feeling that, oh, this was just, this was artistic genius, and it should be given a wide berth because that's just the way we treat it. You know, the 50s was a very sort of bohemian decade anyway in that circle, and there was a lot of outrageous behavior in a lot of ways, and Jackson was just sort of part of that, and so I think he was given much more leeway than he would have been. And, of course, ironically, the more leeway he was given, the more he had to do to get the kind of attention that he so craved. And one could even argue that, to some extent, when he killed himself, when he drove off the road in East Hampton, going 90 miles an hour in the middle of the night down a road, that he was yet again looking for some sort of attention. Now, I don't think it was a conscious attempt to commit suicide. I don't think he would have consciously imperiled someone else. Someone else was killed in the car wreck. But I think it was psychologically indistinguishable from suicide.
Was there a turning point in Pollock's life where he was going from being a struggling artist, trying to paint and draw and get it right, to suddenly he saw a new way to approach the world through his art? What turned him as an artist?
I would say it's a great question. I think there are, probably as in any artist's life, there were a series of points. There were, you could isolate maybe two or three that were key moments in his life. One was when he was a teenager out in Los Angeles, and he had been expelled from school for the third time in 3 years, and he was clearly never going to finish high school. He didn't know what he wanted to do. His art was unrecognized. It was hardly even art at that point. I mean, he was still doing a little bit of clay sculpture and that sort of thing. And he really didn't know where he was going to go. And he got a letter from his older brother, Charles, who was in New York studying with Thomas Hart Benton. And I think that letter was a key turning point in his life. I think meeting Lee Krasner in the early 40s was a key turning point in his life.
What did the letter say about Thomas Hart Benton?
Well, it basically said, you know, Jackson, get your life together. You are worthwhile. You do have something to contribute. Have you thought about being an architect, actually, is the way Charles put it. It wasn't so much exactly what he said as the fact that he said anything, because Jackson had grown up basically ignored by his oldest brother and adoring his oldest brother. And so to get any sort of communication from Charles, I think, was enormously helpful at a very, very needful time in his life. We talk about in the book how he met John Graham in the late 30s. John Graham was a wonderful, enigmatic character in American art, very little known, but actually very...
He was actually a Russian.
He was born in Poland, and his family escaped to Russia, and he was brought up in Russia, and he considered himself Russian. He invented many myths about himself, so he was a very hard man to track down. But wonderfully eccentric man who, as I say, invented himself in many ways, but was crucial for Jackson because Jackson thought he had been to Paris and had met Picasso and had met Matisse and met Braque, and Graham thought Jackson was a great artist, and he communicated that to Jackson. And so it was really the first time in his whole life that somebody who had the legitimacy of the European modernists said to Jackson, yes, you can be a great artist, yes, you have the talent. I think that was a very important moment for him. And the third one, I would say, undoubtedly, was when he met Lee Krasner, for all the emotional reasons, and that was Lee basically allowed him, sort of freed him from his demons for at least a while, and made it possible for him to do his best work. There's no question she had an incredibly important effect on his life, and I don't think he could have had the career he had without her, without any question.
Having done a biography of this great extent on a man's life, is there anything about your lives that you would like to keep hidden and are trying to do so that nobody will come into your life in the same way you have?
I must... we asked ourselves that question. Would we want somebody poking around in our lives to the extent that we were poking around at Jackson's? And our feeling was, especially if, like Jackson, we left no children... there was part of us that would almost hope that, or wish that we could do something important enough that people would care enough to want to poke around that much. The other effect it had is it made us want to know a lot more about our own families. And here we spent at least a year of those 8 years trying to understand Jackson's parents and his childhood, and we realized that we knew a lot more about Pollock's family than we knew about our own, and we did what I would think that many of the listeners might want to do, and that is we sat down with our respective families and systematically interviewed them as if we were interviewing for a book, and we learned incredible things about our parents and about our grandparents that have never come up in just sort of the course of family conversation.
And I think therefore also about yourselves.
And therefore about ourselves, absolutely. So I think anyone who sees how important the understanding of a early family history can be for understanding someone will want to go back and understand their own family history better, and also can see that even families that don't seem to be terribly, you know, world historically important can be absolutely fascinating. I mean, I think we've certainly been told that the Pollock family and even the Lee Krasner family is almost the stuff of great fiction. I mean, to watch this farm family going from one spot in the Midwest to another and off to the far west, moving every couple of years in this great cathartic exercise of motion, was a fascinating story, even though his parents never did anything that would bring them fame except to have parented Jackson Pollock.
Well, thank you very much, Stephen Nafe and Gregory White-Smith, for coming in and talking with us on Fresh Air today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stephen Nafe and Gregory White-Smith's new biography is called Jackson Pollock, An American Saga. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, the screenwriter of On the Waterfront, Bud Schulberg, will come by. I hope you'll join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson with Fresh Air. Geographer Wilbur Zielinski doesn't just locate places on the map. He wanders to find the patterns that define us. Why there are so many hospitals here, why so few restaurants there. Coming up, Wilbur Zielinski talks about emotional topography. Also, India has the world's largest film industry, which means they write a lot of film music. World music critic Milo Miles plays us some of the music for Indian Pictures. And you may remember comic Jim Turner from his work with the Duck's Breath Mystery Theater. Now he has his own act called Walk a Mile in My Head. Critic Laurie Stone has a review. Some audio perambulation on today's Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Bill Redlin. Congressional sources and Pentagon documents indicate President Bush will propose a $7 billion increase in defense spending in fiscal year 1991. The spending package includes five B-2 stealth bombers and money for two land-based nuclear missiles. The budget will be officially released on Monday. Cuts will include a reduction of 38,000 military personnel, mothballing two battleships, and canceling several weapons programs. The administration's budget figures come on the heels of the dramatic changes in Eastern Europe, which had raised speculation a diminishing Soviet threat could lead to smaller military budgets in the United States. Investigators probing the cause of last night's crash of an Avianca jet in New York are now convinced that the Colombian airliner ran out of fuel. At least 66 people were killed. Scores of others were injured. More from NPR's Wendy Kaufman.
Avianca Flight 52 originated in Bogota. Bad weather and heavy traffic delayed the flight by more than an hour. By the time the jet approached the New York area, the crew realized that the plane did not have a lot of fuel left. Air traffic controllers were notified, but the crew did not declare a fuel emergency. The pilot missed his first landing attempt, and as he was going around for a second try, he reported a fuel emergency. A short time later, the crew reported that the plane had lost two engines, apparently because of fuel starvation. Then the plane crashed into a wooded area on Long Island. There was no fire and no explosion. If there had been, the death and injury toll would have been even higher. Investigators are now analyzing the two flight recorders from the jet, and they hope to interview the one surviving crew member to ascertain exactly why Avianca Flight 52 ran out of fuel. This is Wendy Kaufman reporting.
Manuel Noriega has claimed status as a prisoner of war under the Geneva Convention and is asking to be moved to a neutral third country to avoid facing federal drug charges. The claim has been mailed to President Bush and turned up in court papers today in motions filed by his attorney. National Football League Commissioner Paul Tagliabue today denied allegations of racism in the league's drug testing program. NPR's Mark Schramm reports from New Orleans.
The charges were raised in a story by a Washington, D.C. TV station, which alleged the NFL covered up positive cocaine tests by white players while unfairly penalizing blacks. Tagliabue labeled that report a journalistic Molotov cocktail filled with distortions.
If a player tests positive, whether he's a white quarterback, a black quarterback, a white lineman, a black lineman, he gets advice from the team doctor and others, and he gets whatever treatment is best suited to his situation. He gets treatment on a confidential basis.
The commissioner added that many black players have expressed support for the NFL's program. In New Orleans, I'm Mark Schramm reporting.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost more than a point and a half today. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Some of the most widely heard music in other countries is virtually unknown here in the United States. Few Americans listen to film soundtracks from India, but radio and record stores there are filled with them. World music commentator Milo Miles takes us to hear Indian movie music.
சொந்தம் இது ஒரு உண்மை சொல்லும் பந்தம் பூமை நெஞ்சின் சொந்தம் இது ஒரு உண்மை சொல்லும் பந்தம் வார்த்தைகள்.
When some people want light entertainment and music, they turn to new age, funky lounge jazz, or vintage Broadway musicals. Me, I like Indian film music these days. Until very recently, when non-soundtrack cassettes began making inroads, almost all of the domestic pop music in India came from film scores. It's rather like when most of the LPs you could find in this country were recordings of Broadway plays or hit movies. Although Indian soundtracks use everything from traditional sitars and tablas to synthesizers and wah-wah guitars, many film songs are quite mainstream and just what you would expect, sort of pop ragas. This is a selection from a Sajjat Ray soundtrack. But even some of these more traditional tunes can get quite wildly melodramatic. The soundtrack songs I find best for easy listening, however, are the weird ones. The film music composers draw on whatever international sources catch their fancy. This number, for example, suggests a mutant Spanish doo-wop from Bombay. It's sung by S.P. Bala Subramaniam. Indian film directors can work on 10 or more films at the same time. And while the industry turns out hundreds of soundtracks every year, most are done by about a dozen singers. The circle of star vocalists is nearly a closed shop. The queen of them all is Lata Mangeshkar. Between 1948 and 1984, Mangeshkar made more than 30,000 recordings for over 2,000 films, and in more dialects and languages than she can remember. Every other female singer in Indian movies that I've heard imitates her. The great pleasure of Indian film scores are their unexpected turns of style and their sheer pleasure in entertainment. Big string sections and tabla drums are widespread, but a single song can switch from raging electric guitar accompaniment to melancholy accordion to proud bleeding trumpet. The vocals run through all the thrills, chills, heartbreak, and slapstick you remember from classic Hollywood. Best of all, they let you hear modern pop forms like syrupy ballads and road songs in a new way. These soundtracks are truly where there is no east or west, only the big love scene and the catchy theme song. Chinna chinna roja puve chella kanne niyar tappi vanda sippi mutte unnai petra thayar solli kolla Thank you. Indian soundtracks are rare in this country. Most record stores stock only classical Indian music. The British EMI label and Oriental Records of New York put out good collections if you can find them. Your best bet, however, is, if you can, to visit local Indian grocery stores, which will often carry inexpensive cassettes. The anthologies on the Double Apple label have the cleanest sound and the biggest stars.
Milo Miles is a freelance journalist who writes regularly about pop music for The Village Voice. This is Fresh Air. About half the states in the country produce comprehensive state atlases. As a visitor to Philadelphia, my eye was caught by one of the newest, the State Atlas of Pennsylvania. It's a large format, coffee table-sized book, more than 300 pages filled with maps and graphs. Besides the traditional maps you'd expect to find in an atlas that shows us places, there's a section on human patterns that shows us who we are. My guest, geographer Wilbur Zielinski, edited this section. I wanted to know how these other aspects of our culture came to be included in an atlas.
Well, a geographical atlas, Sedge, is a kind of geographic encyclopedia, a combination of maps, photographs, text, graphs, line drawings, whatever will tell the story. Geographers can and should be interested in the totality of a human experience and the physical world as well.
There's a concept that you use in your atlas that I think, although you report on Pennsylvania, could be used for any state in the Union, particularly those where there are baseball fans, and it's the concept of a fan shed instead of a watershed. Could you explain how this idea...
That's not original with us. The fan shed, as best we can define it, is the area within which you have fans for a particular team in a particular sport. And they demonstrate their allegiance to the team by coming to games, obviously, and listening to radio broadcasts thereof or watching TV broadcasts when those are available. And we mapped the fan sheds for the major professional basketball, baseball, and football teams by plotting the location of radio stations that normally carry the broadcasts.
Well, looking at the map, for instance, I can see that there are certain areas where Pirates fans overlap with the Phillies fans, and Yankees overlap with the Mets and the Cleveland Indians.
And the Baltimore Orioles and on, yes.
So you're actually dealing with kind of emotional topography.
Yes.
Rather than actual physical topography.
Yeah. It'd be nice if we could map other aspects of emotional geography. It's a tough proposition. But people in this country get more excited about sport than almost anything else. It's an important thing to map. So we have generous coverage of professional, college, and a few amateur sports.
One of your own studies has been the geography of marriage and marriage days. And I wonder if you could talk a bit what that means.
I've been intrigued with the question of when people, what day of the week and what month of the year people choose for the marriage ceremony. Now, this seems like a trivial question. It's not. In the 19th century, people married in the late fall. October, November, and December were the favored months. June was not important. Then there was a switch starting in one part of the country, the Northeast, and gradually engulfing the whole country. Summer weddings became popular. And there was also a switch from, would you believe it, a maximum on Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays to the weekend, and of course, Saturday. Now, why is this worth looking at? Because it indicates basic social change, basic changes in the way people think. And these, nobody tells you when to get married. It's a personal or family decision. But when millions of people decide to follow a different pattern, it tells you there's been a social revolution, that the nature of American life has changed.
And what was the change that you saw?
Well, from an agrarian society where people, where the most important part of the year was the harvest season, the only season where you had abundance and leisure, to the present period in which we become a society of consumers and where leisure is highly valued, and where we have a 4 or 5 day week where we all think about the weekend and about the summer vacation. That is a tremendous psychological revolution, you might say.
Geographers do research in a number of sometimes imaginative ways. For instance, when you wanted to find out once about how far north the word Dixie was used,
mm-hmm.
You looked through the yellow pages of different communities?
Yeah. I might say that the classified directory is one of my favorite books. The idea is very simple, and it was borrowed from a good friend of mine who's a sociologist who first studied the location of Dixie. You look at a telephone directory and see whether the term, in this case, Dixie or Southern or some variant of that term occurs, and if so, how many times, and compare it with other terms of regional or cultural significance. Doing that, I think I have a pretty good handle on the vernacular regions of North America, the regions as perceived by the people themselves, not by us professional geographers.
So by looking in the phone book and seeing that Dixie Auto Supply or something can be found at a certain point north, you could actually then make a map out of where Dixie is perceived by its residents to be.
Or where the term Dixie is relatively important. Of course, you'll find some of these terms have become universal, but the way they bunch up on the map is, I think, a sensitive indication of the way people perceive their regions.
I want to talk a little bit more about the atlas here. Much of the information in there, it relies on census information. And we have a new census coming up in just a couple of months, yet the atlas is just out, and a lot of the information is from the early 80s. Is this a frustration?
It's a tremendous frustration. In fact, any atlas is obsolete by the time it goes to the printer. And you can't do much about that. Some of the data here, by the way, is much older than 1980. For some items, we had to go back much further, and not just in the historical section. Yeah, it's a major frustration, Sedge, but it's universal. In geography, you're always dealing with a changing world, and between the time you gather your data, analyze it, map it, send it to the printer, get it to the stores or your colleagues, the world has already changed. It's not like a daily newspaper where you're with it just minutes or hours behind the event. We are months or years, sometimes decades behind the reality.
How did you develop your interest in geography and where places are and how people use them?
Well, I guess, like most professional geographers, I was born with the geographic bug, although it took me a long time to discover that fact. About midway through my college career, I discovered I had to make a living, and the only skill I had that was worth developing was a certain aptitude for drawing maps. So I took some training in cartography, and I actually got gainful employment in doing this. The more I worked with maps, the more I realized that what I was really interested in was the much larger related field of geography. And I'm still fascinated by maps. For me, it's the most effective way to understand the world. That's really the geographic project, not just to map things, but using maps as an entree into the nature of reality.
J.B. Jackson, another geographer, once commented on the decline of the crab cake and how it was passing, because it represented the end of crab fisheries, a certain sort of handwork that went into putting the crab cake together. But now with a resurgence of regional cooking and regional cuisine, the crab cake is making its way back onto onto menus. And this seems to be sort of a geographical trend.
It is, and I'm not going to tip my hand, but it's something I we'll be looking at in the near future, the rise of regional cuisines.
Let me ask how an atlas gets put together in this way.
With great difficulty.
if you came to the editorial committee and said, I'd like to put in a map on the spread of the crab cake and where it's found, would that be taken seriously? Would that be laughed at?
No, because we five editors pretty much made our own decisions for the sections and pages for which we had responsibility. So, for example, I put in a map of Little League baseball entirely on my own, which might seem facetious to some people. It's not. Because I used my own judgment, stuck my neck out and said, this is something we have to have. Nobody else has done. Let's put it in.
What was interesting for you about Little Leagues?
Well, this was one of the great surprises. The data were easy to get because the national or international headquarters is in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. They gave us a list with no difficulty. We mapped them, and we discovered a very uneven concentration. Lots around Philadelphia, for example, lots of them up in the Anthracite. Not a single one in Dauphin County, that is Harrisburg, or Lancaster County, or several other counties which are urban where you expect them. I don't know the answer. But you see, the map is... it's like a detective story. Here is the map. There are the clues. Try to solve the mystery.
What is the pleasure that you get from looking at a map? Is it sensual? Is it intellectual? Both?
A map is a work of art. It's also a scientific thing. There's no reason why designed objects, a piece of machinery, an automobile, a useful thing, cannot also be beautiful. We had a very good designer, so we have in these drawings, maps and graphs and whatever, things which are, I think are both useful and a joy to the eye.
Wilbur Zielinski, thank you very much for coming in and being a guest with us on Fresh Air.
It's been great fun. Thank you, Sedge.
Wilbur Zielinski is a professor emeritus of geography at Pennsylvania State University and a co-editor of the New Atlas of Pennsylvania, published by Temple University Press. This is Fresh Air. Later today here on National Public Radio, today's edition of All Things Considered. And joining us for a preview from Washington is co-host Noah Adams. Hello, Noah.
Hi, Sedge. We'll have the latest on the plane crash last night in New York, the Avianca 707 that went down in bad weather there. I'll have a conversation with Jan Pacepa, once the head of the Foreign Intelligence Service in Romania. He defected to the West, to the U.S., in 1978. He's written a book critical of the Ceausescu regime. And he's warning now that the secret police apparatus in Romania has not been dismantled and thus, in his view, stands ready to support a communist government in that country. Also, Robert Siegel goes to a play here in Washington, written by the president of Czechoslovakia.
Those stories and others on All Things Considered later here on National Public Radio. Walk a Mile in My Head is a new series of character sketches from San Francisco comic Jim Turner that he's now performing in New York. Our critic Laurie Stone caught Turner's show and has this review.
Jim Turner is 37, a tall, rangy actor with a mop of yellow hair and a resonant voice. He's known to MTV audiences as the brain-scrambled hippie relic Randy of the Redwoods, and he's been a member of the comedy troupe Duck's Breath Mystery Theater for 14 years. The quick change training graces his solo work. He glides among his incarnations, shedding layers of pants, adjusting his face from gee-whiz innocent to armored con man. Wherever he appears, you can bet there'll be some acrylic fur from hell, the kind of acid-colored shag a guy would use to line his 57 Chevy, his love grotto. Turner's landscape is strewn with pizza crusts and gin flasks. It's a world of stubble and unsettling smells on the fingers that can't quite be placed the next morning. His characters are depressives on the fringe of showbiz and the vain, cynical windbags to whom the despairing are ineluctably drawn. the character Tom E. Dell is a puppeteer who frequently loses his thread, but when he doesn't, he maneuvers a retinue of damaged and dyspeptic puppets. They seek out a wizard to whom they put the question, when do we start feeling better about ourselves? Their ineffectual, blunt guru declares that there is no cure for their pain. Another denizen, Chome Underhill, is, on the other hand, never at a loss for words. Decked out in spandex pants and a wig of flowing curls, he leads women in a training session designed to purge the masque-femme facade, as well as sell them vitamins.
And ladies, let me just say this about being your personal trainer. I am not here to be your best friend. I am not some kind of feel-good preacher. I am a scientist. A jogger and an ex-lawyer. And you are a pastiche. That's all I need to know. You are here because you know that the truth is a frown that sometimes hurts to wear. And over the next year of the personal training, I will be that hurting frown.
Walk a Mile in My Head grows funnier as it unfurls, each study enriching Turner's clowning. Like the most compelling foolery, that of Steve Martin and Richard Pryor, for instance, Turner's work arouses as much anxiety as it tames. Puppeteer Tom E. Dell crudely handles and sometimes even drops his puppets. His set evokes the nightmarishness of childhood, of being at the mercy of adult control, at the same time that it offers the horror show thrill of watching others suffer.
Hey, mister! Ah! You said that to me, I have to kill you now. Oh, what's your problem today, buddy? What's my problem? Yeah, right. Everybody thinks I got weird skin. Well, I don't. This is bubble wrap.
Turner stays clear of poignance, preferring thwacks in the gut, but his work remains human and funny because he deftly fleshes his creations. The character Grudge Hansen, a perennial wanderer and car culture maven, recites a jarring pseudo-beat poem called My Love is a Slow-Moving Vehicle. Turner doesn't mistake damage for courage or accomplishment. He fully inhabits his characters. There's no translating, no smirking, no patronizing. His hucksters, deadbeats, and failures at love and work aren't someone else.
Jim Turner is performing at Steve McGraw's in Manhattan through February 11th. Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic. Our interviews are produced by Phyllis Myers and Amy Sallet. Naomi Person produces the music reviews and arts commentaries. Joan Tuohy and Roberta Shorrock edit and mix the review and interview segments. It's been a pleasure to work with them these past 3 weeks, and Terry Gross returns to work with them next time. I'm Sedge Thompson.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, writer Bud Schulberg. He wrote the screenplay for On the Waterfront. Now he's published a new collection of short stories. And Leanne Schreiber with the memoir of a loved one's death. That and more next time on Fresh Air.
Piano Jazz is made possible through grants from Exxon Corporation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and National Public Radio. Hi, I'm Marion McPartland. My guest today is Michel Camilo, and he's one of the brightest and most exciting pianists on the scene today. His whirlwind approach to his music, technical brilliance, and exciting Latin rhythms make him a